The time once again is 8:30. You are listening to WART Wart Radio, which means it is time for Demo or Bust 2010. Everyone, and welcome to the third edition of Demo or Bust 2010. And I'm gonna say really quickly that the aim of this program has changed a little bit. Where it was narrating a personal project of mine in just writing a demo. Maybe that's a little bit boring, right? So instead, we're gonna be interviewing people generally and talking about demo stuff and computer stuff and 3D stuff. But before we get into any of this, let's listen to some chiptune music, because chiptune music is awesome.
Thank you.
That was Sorcerer's Battle by our friend Bert Kaufman. And during the last block party, he performed this live, and we had such a fun time dancing. Like there's no tomorrow to it. I lost my necklace during that episode, but it was a lot of fun. This particular song is really heavy on the FM synthesis, and I just want to tangent for a bit. FM synthesis being kind of a favorite technique of mine. I'll explain it very briefly. It is a two waves. It's a wave whose input frequency is modulated by another wave. Typically, these are sine waves. So if you have like a sine wave modulated by a low frequency sine wave, that sound, you get kind of a sort of sound from that. The theory is that provided that you have an infinite domain of frequencies to choose for these two oscillators, you generate once they get past sort of a Nyquist frequency, you generate these harmonics, and the combination of these harmonics, you build a Fourier system so you can recreate pretty much any wave. And that's the theory behind it, but in actuality, you don't have an infinite number of frequencies to choose from, so they made up for it by making it fucko complex. Typically, FM synthesizers have different algorithms, what are called algorithms, of different oscillators that are put together in different ways. Let me play really quick, very briefly, from a panel that Vert did at Block Party 2008, in which he describes FM synthesis. You should watch it, but this is a quick audio clip of a ramp up of a one frequency modulated by a frequency that is ramping up to give you an idea of what it sounds like. So we'll be right back in like 2 seconds.
Now an interesting thing happens. I'm going to first vibrate it real fast so you can see it going all over the place. Now we're slowing it down to a very simple oscillation. Now I'm going to speed it up. And I'm going to continue speeding it up every so often so you can actually listen to when it makes that transformation. Now we take away the vibration, and it's just a simple sine wave. And then we put it back. Now it's a complete sound. That is FM in its most basic form. Now all those little spikes that you saw there, those are sidebands. And it's still not actually a concrete waveform, you know, a single sound.
Do it again.
All right, I'll do it again. Actually, I have more visual aids coming up, so you'll get to see those. I'll run out of time if I go back and forth.
Again, I like that person. That was it's kind of funny. So we are going to be talking to IQ from RGBA, more or less specifically about ray marching. And before we get into ray marching, I do want to discuss ray tracing, because I feel that ray marching is kind of an offshoot of ray tracing. And just as a preface, so you have an idea of what we're talking about. So, ray tracing is a technique for synthesizing 3D scenes on a computer, on a 2D screen, have a 3D image. And the idea behind this is that you can do this through light. If you have a light source, for instance, in a world, and you have a sphere, and the light emanates from this light source and bounces off the sphere and is all over the place in this world and maybe bounces off a few other objects. If the beams of light go into a lens, this lens sort of bounces the light around in my head. Like, I don't know the equation quite offhand, but it curves the light into a focal point, and somewhere in between this focal point and the lens is some film or a retina or something. And the idea is that the light that is intersects with this film is coherent from the lens such that you can generate an image from it. If you think about it, just like go for a walk or something and think about it, and it's cool because all 3D can just be generated from light, if that makes sense. And so how you do this in a computer is very difficult because you can't really go from a light source to a film simulating this easily at all, because the lens will only intersect like less than 1% of the total light in the scene. So if you compute all the light beams that come out of the light source, you have to forget 99% of them, a little bit more so. And so that's not very efficient at all. So what you can do though is do this backwards, because most of the equations for just the equations for bouncing light and optics and things like that just can be done either way. So forget the lens. This lens thing is far too complex, because the coherence to to decohere an image in such a way to represent it how it was before it was cohered together by this lens is very, very difficult. So instead, what we can do is we can skip all this, forget the lens, and project what are called rays out from a camera position, being sort of the focal point of the lens, more or less, intersecting a plane. This plane being, say, a screen of 1024 by 1024 pixels, say. And so you create these rays called vectors that start at your camera position, your sort of focal position, and intersect a point in the screen where this pixel is, and that kind of like becomes how the light would cohere in a lens, sort of. Like it lacks an artifact from actually having a lens called focus, which you can't really do focus easily in traditional ray tracers. Of course, they have evolved quite a bit over the years. But so you have these vectors coming out, and then you can do all the optics backwards. So you check all the objects that are in your world and see if they intersect with one of them. If they intersect with a sphere, for instance, you have this vector sphere intersection, which you can figure out exactly where it intersects quadratically. And then you figure out what the normal is of this object that you just intersected with a sphere. It's usually the normal is just a vector from the point where it intersected to the center of the sphere, and then you bounce it off this normal. If the sphere is reflective, you bounce it off, and it just bounces off like light would be bouncing off. And you continue doing this until you intersect with an object that is not reflective, and then you take the dot product of a vector from the light source to your intersection, and that becomes the amount of light that is present there. That kind of simulates sort of the fading away aspect, if that makes sense. If you have a light source that whose rays are approaching parallel to your object's normal, and that's it. So that's the technique. This has been practiced for a while, and it's traditionally a very slow technique. So it's been sped up considerably, but before, I don't want to get into all of this by myself. I want to talk with IQ about this. So let's take a musical break, as we always do, and we'll be right back with IQ of RGBA. just listened to was Ocean Machine, an Amiga demo by the Black Lotus.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's just a gorgeous soundtrack. Did you like anything about this demo, out of curiosity?
Oh, no, I don't know. I like the soundtrack.
You like the soundtrack?
That's it. Yeah, yeah. Well, I like it in general, the demo, of course. It's very, very technically good demo.
Yeah.
But I have never been an Amiga coder myself, so I don't really know how good it is.
Yeah.
I just know it is good, and I like the effects, but I cannot really appreciate. But still, I like the demo and the mood and the sound. I don't know.
Well, they have some pretty good models as far as the Black Lotus is concerned. I've seen for a lot of their Amiga demos, which I don't know. It seems to me to be kind of removed from the platform, more or less. So that's good.
Yeah.
Like that. Like, I don't know, I'm not too much of an Amiga person either, but it's...
Me neither. I just follow the PC demo scene, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah, me more or less, too. But let's see here. So, you are a member of RGBA.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And when did you join RGBA?
Sorry?
I'm sorry?
I didn't understand the last question.
Oh, when did you join RGBA?
When? I think it was in the 98.
Well,
it wasn't, we weren't called RGBA yet. We were called Genesis or Genesis. But later on we became RGBA, but we are still the same people.
Okay.
So we first met in the 98, I think, at university.
Now, are you all met together and formed this group? Are you a founder?
Yeah, well, I was there since the beginning, almost.
You're there since
the
beginning.
Yeah. And, well, actually, today, there aren't many RGBA members who are active. It's basically me, and then R3D, which is a modeler and graphician. That's pretty much it, because the other coders, they are doing other stuff, like Spectrum video games and things like that. Or they went into the Linux scene, but really making demos is just me and R3D. But well, we never lose the hope, and we are trying to convince the others to join and come back. But well, we will see.
Are they impressed by some of the demos that you've been releasing?
Yeah, of course they are, but still I'm not doing good enough, apparently, to convince them to come back. I should try harder. But, yeah, so that's why in the last times I have been looking for people to collaborate with.
I see.
Like, working with people from other groups and so on. And I think that's nice also, because so far all the members of RGBA, we were Spanish.
Yeah.
And I think it's nice to make productions with people from other countries.
How many, just out of curiosity for myself, how many, how popular is how many Spanish groups are there? I know there's Explosive, and that's about it.
We have, maybe you know also, Extravaganza.
Mm.
This was a popular group in 2003-2004. Then in the old days, in the 90s, we had Iguana, which they made third position, I think, at Assembly a few times. And today we also have, so we have Explosive indeed. Then we have Spons, which are doing Amiga, Macintosh demos mostly.
Yeah.
And then you have Collapse, which are doing 4K, and then you have Fusion, which are doing 4K intros also, and they won, I think they did second position on Breakpoint, or even won, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there are a few groups, but I think it's most of the times they don't show up in international parties, they stay in Spanish events and competitions. So,
how many, out of curiosity, what Spanish parties are there that you've gone to personally?
We have a huge one, like it's called Euskal Party,
yeah.
And that's in the north of Spain, and normally it gathers 5,000 people. So it's kind of assembly thing, that in Spain. But most of them are not singers. So the party was a demo scene party in the beginning, in the 90s, because now I think they are in the 17th edition already, or 18th, I don't know. But in the beginning it was pure Amiga demo scene party, then it was PC, and in the last years it's mostly for gamers and people, I don't know, doing all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we only go 10, 20 demo sceners today. But
really?
It's a huge party. And then we have In Barcelona, we also have another party, BCN party, which is only for demo singers, and we gather 50 to 100 people. It's not a lot, but yeah. And then we had, in the best times, in the early, so in the 2000, 2001, we had like 4 or 5 parties during the year. And that was nice. But today we only have Euskal Party, which is this huge event, not really demo scene related anymore. But that's why we are starting now to go outside a bit.
So, if you don't mind me asking, what was the first party you've been to, just in general? Like, when did you first become aware? You were mentioning, it sounds like you go back to the early 90s. When did you first become aware of the demo scene?
In 98, actually, the very first, the same year I joined. So when I knew about demo scene, I said, okay, I joined this thing. I like it. Because I was already doing demos myself without knowing anything about demo scene. Well, demos, they weren't demos as we normally say about demos. They didn't have music and so on, but I was doing effects and many algorithms.
Yeah.
And when I saw there were others doing the same thing, I said, okay, I'm going to join them now. So as soon as I knew them, in the 98, 97, I think, I just joined.
Yeah, it's kind of similar for me a little bit. Just when I was growing up, I did a lot of sort of graphical things, if that makes sense, and like little tests and demonstrations. But I wasn't aware of demos or what they were, and so you know, had I known back then, that's immediately what I would have done. And so I'm just starting to get into it myself. I became aware of demos very recently, to be honest with you. Yeah.
But I think in the end, if someone likes the demo scene, they will find it in the end. I mean, it's like, I think a few days ago, Gargai was saying on Poet, in one of the threads, that the demo scene is destiny. So in the end, you are going to find it somehow. So, yeah. Normally people, there is all sorts of people that like programming, others like doing effects, graphics, but in the end, they will end up on the demo scene if they have to.
Yeah.
Otherwise they will stay in other scenes or whatever, like game scenes or whatever. But,
Is Destiny. Do you mind if we take a quick break and play Kinder Painter?
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah, perfect.
All right. Everyone, this is demo, right? So you gotta watch it. It's not just audio. Okay, that was Kinder Painter. The Piat ID on that is 26751. The URL is http://www.piat.net/prod.php?which=26751. Now, IQ, this is a GPU ray tracer, as I understand.
Yes.
And it seems like you have at least a couple of reflection rays going on here. There's a couple of cylinders, a couple of spheres, a couple of planes.
Yeah. Actually, this is a very typical ray tracing scene.
Yeah.
In fact, it's called white ray tracing. So this is ray tracing as it was designed in the 80s. So the very first ray tracers were doing exactly this. So spheres, cylinders, planes with reflection and shadow rays. And pretty much, so no global illumination or ambient occlusion or soft shadows, no motion blur, none of these effects that are needed today to have a nice image. So this is a very, very simple ray tracing as it was done in the 80s. So it shows the typical primitives like spheres, cylinders, and planes.
No, you are.
But it's quite limited because in the 80s it was like, whoa, but today no one is impressed anymore by spheres and cylinders. So that's why Kinderpainter was my first experiment on the GPU. And then I said, okay, we have to move along and do something else than sphere.
Yeah.
And then the other productions came. Yeah.
Well, you are doing a bit of motion blur. May I ask how you're doing that? Are you doing that with a motion buffer of some sort and then blurring by that? Or?
In fact, the real-time demo doesn't have any motion blur.
Oh, really?
Only the video that I recorded with motion blur. Yeah. But the thing is that there is some of the movements on the sphere that are too fast. And when I recorded the video at 30 frames per second, that was not enough. The frame rate was not fast enough to capture the movement of the spheres. Mm. The sampling rate was not enough because the spheres were moving faster than at 30 movements per second, let's say. So I had to render it with motion blur so that you could understand that the spheres were moving.
You hear that, fellas? The truth is out. I'm watching the video capture here. Well, you know, I don't have a very good card as far as processing programs on the GPU.
That's the problem of intros today. Most of the 4K intros, they are really abusing the GPU.
Yeah.
Watch them. That's a pity. That one. What can we do?
Well, when did you start programming on the GPU? I mean, when did this this is 2006. Kinderpainter is. When do you think that this approach has reached? When do you think this was possible to program just pretty much rasterizers of any sort you want on the GPU? When did this first start to appear in the scene?
When?
Yeah, not
it started to be possible.
When did we start to see people actually start to write ray tracers and ray mergers and other such things?
It was 2006 or something. So the main feature we were missing before to do ray tracing on the GPU was the ability to do conditional jump.
Yeah.
So normally the GPU, you have to program the GPU to do your effects, you have to put some code in it in the GPU. That's normally written in GLSL or HLSL languages, which are similar to C. But these languages were very limited before 2006. So you couldn't do an if statement. And you need that to do a ray tracer, because your pixel, your ray, either intersects a sphere or a plane or another object. And then you have to choose how you are going to shade or compute a normal based on which object you hit. And to do that, you need an if. So if I hit sphere, I do that. If I hit a plane, I do the other thing. So before we had the if instruction on the graphics card, we couldn't do it. And I think it was in the 2006 or 2005 with Shader Model 3 graphics cards that we had this ability. So I think it was at that time when we started to see the first ray tracers. And not only ray tracers, but it was really an explosion of effects, not only on the ray tracing field, but everywhere, like post-processing effects, motion blur effects, texturing, procedural animation, all sorts of things on the GPU when we finally had the Pixel Shader 3. Yeah.
Okay. So now a technique that's becoming more and more so in vogue seems to be ray marching, which is an adaptation of ray tracing as I see it. Could you talk very quickly about the just the technique of ray marching?
Well, so before the technique, I would like perhaps to say why we are doing ray marching today, and that's because, as Kinderpainter is showing, with ray tracing you can only intersect spheres and planes and cylinders, because these are shapes which have very simple mathematical representation, and that means that you can mathematically solve the problem of intersecting your ray with these primitives. So the intersection, the way to solve the intersection is through a formula, which is known, and you just type the formula in the code and you have the intersection point. But if you want to go beyond spheres and planes, and you are lacking the mathematical formula for your shapes, because what's the formula for a mushroom, or what's the formula for a forest? So then you have to use something else than ray tracing, and that's where ray marching comes into the game a bit. And the techniques are like Basically, a ray marcher is just like a ray tracer. The way the lighting is done, the way the animation is done, the way the rendering is done is exactly the same. It's only the intersection computations that are replaced. So instead of computing the intersections with formulas, you do it in another way. And that way is what we really call the ray marcher. And what we are doing here basically is to take the ray, which normally is used to detect an intersection, and instead of computing the intersection with a formula, we just take the ray and slowly test in brute force, if you want, like trying to find in a way somehow where the ray hits your primitive. And that's done, again, not by solving a formula, but by just testing. So basically you take a point in your ray and you say, okay, am I inside the primitive or not? And if you are not, you take another point. And then you try again. Okay, I'm now inside the primitive. Did I hit something? Yes or no? If you didn't, you try again another point, and so on until you find the point. And there is many, many ways to choose these points, to choose how you test different points along the ray. So the easiest is just to take one after the other, like advancing in the direction of the ray. That's the simplest one, but there are many other ways to do it. Like you have bisection methods, you have Newton-Raphson methods, you have many, many ways to try to choose your points in an optimal way, so your chances to hit the object are higher. But for 4 kilobytes demos, we are just doing the simple way, which means you start in the origin of the ray, and you slowly step along the ray until you hit something. And yeah, that's pretty much so. It's a very powerful technique, because the primitive, the description of the primitive doesn't have to be mathematically simple anymore. It doesn't have to be a sphere or a plane. It can be anything you want. You can invent any sort of formula you want, and then something will appear on the screen, let's say. So it's like you can really model anything you want. You just need to know a bit of formula and mathematics, but not really a lot, and then you can kind of sculpt the shapes you want through these formulas. But you don't really need to solve the formula, just write them. You just have to write them to describe your object, and then the ray marcher will find the intersection. You don't have to do it yourself anymore. So it's a very powerful technique. And yeah, now everyone is, actually everyone jumped into this technique because it's very simple to program and it gives very good results. Yeah, so that's a bit the ray marching.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and it's the thing that I find kind of intriguing by it is you can combine formulas where you have something that twists space. You can combine that in before your tests of like a cube.
Yeah, it's really, really powerful. Like as you are saying, you can have a formula which models an object A, you can have another formula which models object B, and then you can put into the game a third formula which blends the two previous formulas, and then the object A and the object B will blend also, the shapes will blend. And you can also, as you said, twist an object by adding some trigonometric formulas to the base formula. You can stretch, you can bend, you can do a lot of things. So it's a very, very powerful modeling tool, actually. The problem with this is that an artist cannot use it, because obviously modelers and graphicians, they don't know about mathematics. So it's still a coder who has to do the modeling. That's why we are still seeing 4K intros with cubes and rings and planes instead of something more beautiful. But yeah, so I think the next step now would be to find a way to give all this technique and put it in the hands of an artist. But I don't know how that will happen, if anyone will come with a brilliant idea and do something. But that would be ideal, that we could put this technique in the hands of the artists.
Well, I imagine if you wrote an editor, a modeler for this technique, it would most certainly, I would think, have to preview at least with ray marching to do a polygonal sort of modeling sort of scheme. I don't think would work at all. And so in that sense, the rendering technique is very tied to the model that it draws, which I find kind of intriguing, to be honest with you. I'm looking at a picture, you have this 4K procedural graphics called SliceX, which is fucking gorgeous, if I should say so myself. I have a couple of questions. First of all, okay, so once you determine where in space a ray has intersected with an object, how do you determine the object's normal?
That's done with a technique which is called central differences. So the thing is that when you have your primitive and your objects defined with mathematical formulas, basically all the space, or all the volume of your 3D scene becomes what we call a scalar field. It's like in reality, like at any point in space, you can always measure the pressure of air or the temperature. And that means for every point in space, you have this temperature. And then the normal of your surfaces, they are tied, or they are related to the gradient of this field, which is a mathematical concept related also to the derivatives and other properties of the of this 3D scalar field. But basically what we are doing is to take the intersection point and look a bit to the to other points around this intersection point and check if in these other points the distance to the primitives is smaller or higher than in the current point. And depending where which of these points has a closer distance than your point, you can know to which direction the surface is oriented. It's like in you, if you are in the step of a mountain or in a hill, and then you want to know how the hill is oriented, you can just look to your left, and say, okay, in my left the hill is lower than me, and in my right the hill is going up. So that means my surface is oriented from right to left. And if you got the opposite, like in the left I have more height than here, and in my right I have less, then the surface is oriented in the other direction. So we are doing kind of this thing, but in 3D. And the technique is called central differences. So if anyone wants to check on the internet or on Google or something, that's the term. It's very simple. You basically have to evaluate your scalar field or your distance field again 4 times or 6 times. There is 2 techniques to do it. One is more accurate than the other one is faster. But so if you do it in the fast way, you just have to take 4 points. If you do it in the slower way, you have to take 6 points, and you evaluate the distance field 6 times, and you the small formula, and you get your normal. It's quite simple.
My other question is, the shadows on SLICEX are very diffuse. I'm wondering how you're doing, how you're determining what's in shadow.
This was a big hack. It's a big trick or cheat, but it did work quite okay. And because normally, indeed, in a ray tracer, in a classic ray tracer, you have how do you call it, hard shadows, I think. Like the places which are in shadow and the parts which are not in shadow are very well split into groups. Like this is in shadow, this is not, and you can't see the edge of the shadows normally in a classic ray tracer. And professional ray tracers, they have soft shadows indeed, like diffuse shadows, and that's what I try to do too, but in a very different way, because professional ray tracers, what they do is to cast thousands of shadow rays. It's like they have thousands of lights, and that gives thousands of hard shadows, but the average gives a soft shadow. But I didn't want to do that. I couldn't afford to cast thousands of rays. So I did it only with one ray, which goes from the intersection point or the pixel you are lighting to the light source. And in this ray, I was taking 5 points along the ray that were equidistant, like all at the same distance from each other. And in these 5 points, I was computing again the distance to the closest primitive. I was just evaluating again the distance field.
So that's
if the 5 points are very close to something, then your point is most likely to be in shadow, in complete shadow. But if only 2 of them are very close to an object and the other 3 are far, then your shadow is probably going to be softer, like it will have a bit more light. And by using these 5 points and the 5 distances to any geometry, I was kind of mixing all these values together to give a soft shadow.
It really doesn't look bad for 5 points.
No, it works quite okay. Well, it's very tuned for this. I mean, all the parameters of this technique were tuned for this image.
Yeah.
It's not a generic thing that works for everything. But, well, it was good enough and it did work. And I don't know, I'm quite proud of it, actually. Because it works very well.
Do you now as I've heard from you before, and unfortunately there you have this you did a panel for Envision, and the recording I had of it was cut halfway off. And so you're beginning, if you don't mind me asking, you're beginning to you're going to describe. It seems that there is a definite computational difference between primary arrays and secondary arrays. It's much less expensive for secondary arrays as opposed to how expensive it is for traditional ray tracers. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes and no. So the thing was that in a traditional ray tracer, to do these effects beyond the pure reflective and half shadows, like, so normally in a ray tracer, to do the soft shadows or ambient occlusion or global illumination effects, which really bring a lot of richness to the image, these effects are very expensive because you have to cast thousands of rays. But with the distance field, you can apply tricks as the one I just described of the soft shadows, and you can get the same effects in a very cheap way. So while a normal ray tracer spends most of the time in the secondary rays or in the special effects, with the ray matching in distance fields, it's actually these special effects take very, very little time, a lot less than the basic rendering, which is completely the opposite of normal renderers. And that makes the technique very interesting. For example, in this image, with the soft shadows and all that, you also have ambient occlusion, which is a technique that brings extra shadows to the parts of the model which are very close to some geometry, like when you have a wall and the floor, and then this part of the scene where the floor and the wall are connecting to each other, that part normally should be a bit darker, a bit more dark than the center of the wall, where it's really exposed to the light, while the bottom part is more in shadow. So these kind of effects, and ambient occlusion effects, normally are very, very expensive, but with the distance fields, you can do them almost for free. Like, it takes less than, I don't know, 5% of the rendering time.
Well, okay, how are you doing the like, the pillars that reach the floor? How are you doing the shadows that go around that?
So, the ambient occlusion is done again, by using tricks of the distance fields. Like, so you have a point, and basically what you want to do is to know if this point that you are lighting or shading, you want to know if this point is very, exposed to the light sources, or if it's really hidden, if it's really, like, hidden behind some geometry, and if the light is not really able to access that point.
So I don't understand. So the geometry of the pillar, geometry of the ground, is what?
Or the ground, or the monster, or the whatever. So basically, you take a few points again around your shading point, and you see if these points are inside the geometry or not, if they are really floating in the air. And that you can do by taking the distance field and evaluating it in these points. So again, let's say you take 5 points around your point, your shading point, and you say, okay, are these points inside some geometry, like a column, or they are below the floor? And if 3 of them they are and 2 of them are not, it means that this point is not very, it's half hidden by geometry.
So
but if all of them were just floating in the air and not inside of anything, then this point is actually very exposed to the light, and then it's very light.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So the point isn't you're not computing 5 rays from one single point. You're computing it from like a volume.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, and normally in a ray tracer, this would be done with casting thousands of rays, and here you don't even have to cast any ray. Just evaluate the function few times here and there in few points, and voila, you have the shading. And that's really cool.
Are there any heuristic methods? Is there anything that can be gained from primary arrays and secondary arrays would find useful, do you think? I mean, within the GPU sort of frame architecture, it seems like that wouldn't be possible, but are there any tricks that you've used? As far as speeding things up based on either pre-computed data or...
No, pre-computation at all. Everything done on the fly, from scratch. So, yeah, there is no pre-computations or anything. It's very plain code, just there, no special optimizations or anything. Just, but you know, GPUs are so fast today that especially when you are coding 4K production, you don't really care about the speed anymore. It's just about how much you can fit in the 4K. And to make more room into your executable, you just drop all the acceleration techniques or all the tricks. So normally we just code the plain basic algorithm without any speed up or any trick, and just let the hardware handle it. And yeah, so in this case also there isn't any other trick other than the fast ambient occlusion and the soft shadows, which are more, not really a trick, but a technique, you could say.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Now, are you testing whether an object is within or without a particular geometry? Are you testing every geometry per race step?
Yes. Right now, yeah. Yeah. Normally, one should use an octree or something to discard objects that are too far, for example. But in the case of all the 4K productions I have done so far, everything was tested for every race. But really, it's really brute force. Really a brute force approach. But it works quite okay. However, now every people doing 4K productions with ray matching, we are discussing new ways to accelerate all this, to make it even faster. And right now, there is in Poet a very nice thread, the one you started, by the way, where most of the coders who have been using this technique are discussing how we could make it faster. So there is, I proposed to use 3D textures to pre-compute some of the distance fields and store it in a lookup table or in a 3D texture. Others were speaking about casting many rays in one go, like a complete group of rays, and try to make them move together so that you can save computations. Like you can do the computations only once for all these rays, and in case the computations are valid for them, just keep on doing like that until you have to break the group of rays into individual rays. So there is many ways we can probably speed it up. But the problem is all these techniques will take more space. They will take half kilobyte, a quarter kilobyte, or 1 kilobyte of the code. So I don't know what will happen. But if we weren't doing this in 4 kilobytes and we were doing it in demos or 64K, then, yeah, I think there would be a lot of tricks we could apply for accelerating all this. But in 4K, I'm not sure yet if we will see any of these techniques really being applied. I don't know.
Well, the simple geometries here without fancy optimization techniques still look pretty cool. Like, they're still, I think they still have a little bit of time to live, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think we still will see spheres and cubes and these things for 1 year or so before. Yeah, but I mean, they look nice, huh? It's like most of these 4K intros we have seen in the last year or 2 years, they are very, very nice. You can enjoy them a lot, even if they are still spheres. But they are shiny, they have shading effects, they have the right color, the right music, and they look very, very nice. But we will see one day, and I think one day in 2 years or so, we'll start to see more complex geometry and so on. For example, these graphics we were discussing with the pillars and the columns and the monster and all that, apparently they were reporting that it runs at 10 frames per second already today.
Oh, wow.
Current GPUs. So this was released 1 year ago, I think, or 2 years ago, and at that time, I think it was like half frame per second or 0.5 frames per second. And today it's already 10 frames per second. So I wouldn't be surprised if in 2 years more, 3 years, we could see these things real time, completely real time, 4 kilobytes. With the monster moving around and destroying the columns and the roof falling down and this kind of thing. So yeah, probably yes. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, we have to dream, huh?
Well, it's still the fact that we can do ray tracing alone real time is still kind of amazing to me, if that makes sense.
Mm. Well, actually, normally in the demo scene, when we think about ray tracing, we think about planes and cylinders. But There is another scene out there which are they are doing ray tracing on polygons, not in spheres on planes, but really in normal meshes in 3D objects, like done in Max or Maya or whatever.
They're getting a good performance from this?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I was also in that scene a few years ago, and even worked professionally on that, and you can render a few million polygons in real time with a dual core machine today. So yeah, yeah, it's quite amazing. Actually, in the demo scene, we are quite slow. We didn't catch up with them because they are really doing nice ray tracing. It's all based on KD trees and op trees and bonding volume hierarchies and other techniques to accelerate the intersections. And they are using very specific, special ways of storing data on the memory, which is very efficient for cache, coherence, and so on. And basically, you can do real-time ray tracing of a few million polygons. Like, it's pretty impressive, actually. You need a lot of memory to store all the KD tree and op trees in memory, but it's absolutely doable today. So, yeah, it's very,
they're getting
very
good reflections and other...
No, normally they are doing just primary rays and shallow rays.
I see.
Then I invented some techniques to do ambient occlusion in real time by casting just four rays per pixel of ambient occlusion and then blurring the ambient occlusion information in screen space. But, yeah, but normally it's with simple effects, no reflections and so on. But anyway, I think the reflections are... they are not that important in the end, I think, in reality. In the demo scene, we are abusing of them. We like to have spheres reflecting spheres, which reflect more spheres, and so on. But when you look around you in reality, I don't know how many objects you see which are reflective, no? You know, I have here my window, which is now reflecting a bit. But that's it. I don't see many reflective objects.
Well,
but I don't know. In demo scene, we have this fetish of reflecting spheres and cubes. I don't know why.
Well, it's very impressive to see a sphere reflecting a sphere.
Yeah, it's cool. And for some reason, it's like hypnotizing. I don't know why. It's very cool. But but if you look around you, you don't see that many reflective spheres. I walk here in my apartment. I go to the streets to walk, and I don't see reflective spheres anywhere. But they look very cool. Yeah. For some reason.
Yeah, I'm looking around right now, and aside from the CDs that are here, of course. There really isn't anything. The only thing that there isn't anything that's reflecting anything aside from light. But that's not really reflecting, right? So.
Yeah.
But
Well, everything reflects a bit of light, of course, because that's the principle of global illumination. Like the light hits an object, and that light is kind of bounced or reflected in another direction, and so on and so on. But perfect reflections, like mirror reflections. We don't see that many, I think, during the day.
So, you know, since I have you on the phone, I'm sorry, you probably get this, I have to talk about Elevated.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, let's go to Elevated. We'll be back in 1 second.
Thank you.
right, we're back. That was elevated. The Piaut ID on this is 52938. Now this is a 4K, a 4K demo. And what party was this released at?
Breakpoint.
Breakpoint 2009.
Yes.
It seems pretty popular as far as demos.
Oh, yeah,
are
yeah. I don't know what we did, but it became very popular and very quickly. In fact, it's like. I remember, so it was a collaboration between RGBA and TBC,
yeah.
And the guys of TBC, they made Atrium before, who won Breakpoint 2008.
Out of curiosity, who did the synth? Because the synth is gorgeous in my opinion.
Yes, oh, it's amazing. When they sent me the first version of the music, I was like, wow, we are going to win. I don't know what images we will have, but we are going to win anyway. It was really good. So these guys, they made this very other successful 4K intro, and apparently they were very happy because in YouTube they got like 40,000 views or something in 1 week.
Mm.
And the guys were going crazy because we got 40,000 in 2 days, not in a few weeks, but in 2 days. So I don't know what happened with Elevated, but people really liked it a lot. And I think in YouTube we are now in the 400,000 views or something, which is a lot. Especially taking into account that we don't have boobs or dancing girls or porn at all. It's just mountains and a 4K intro, and lots of people is watching it. So we are really, really happy.
Well, it looks like it's very photo. It looks very photo-esque. You have a sort of, it looks like you have,
yeah.
Everything's not lit the same. It's kind of darker on the edges, maybe.
Yeah.
You have sort of a lens, sort of,
yeah.
Specular, yeah. Sort of.
Yeah, actually, this was a bit my... the thing I wanted to try this time with this production, to do something that didn't look too much computer-made. It looks computer-made, of course, but I tried to apply all these effects you have in real cameras, like indeed darkening the borders of the screen, you have the grain or the noise in the image, you have the color distortion, you have light flickering, like the screen is all the time flickering, the intensity, the overall intensity of the image.
Oh, is it? I gotta watch it again. Huh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have to watch the real-time version, because in the video, these effects are just, most of them are just gone with the MPEG or DVX compression.
I'll have to go to my friends. It's funny.
Yes.
I just have a horrible computer as far as demos are concerned.
It's time to change.
So, that will have to change.
Well, I know, because my computer is quite crappy too. And in fact, I did program Elevated at a very, very, very low resolution.
Yeah.
Like 100 by 80 pixels, so just 100 pixels, and then I could see it real time, because normally it was running at 2 FPS, 3 FPS frames per second. So most of the productions I make them in very, very small window, and then I see them in big screen only in the party, but not before.
Oh really? Yes. Are you pretty confident that they still work correctly, or do you think anything will be broken in? Have you had that experience out of curiosity where you produce something?
The demo, you mean that they will become incompatible or something?
I don't know. Like, will the frame rate just be as slow because of something you had not seen with this resolution or something like that? Or have you had any surprises seeing something
no,
for the first
well,
time?
No. Well, the surprises are that it looks nicer in big screen. But otherwise, no. I can code in small resolution with no problem. From time to time, I render a video to see what I'm doing, but normally it works quite okay for me to do it in small resolution. Yeah.
Now, out of curiosity, how much in Elevated are you doing in the CPU?
How many I'm doing on the CPU for Elevated?
Just what are you doing? I mean, the terrain looks like it's probably vertex shaded.
Yeah, well, we are in the CPU. We are just we're playing the music, of course, which is computed on the CPU, and then at runtime we are just doing the parameter interpolation. Like there is some parameters to control the screen intensity or the camera position, and these things are interpolated on the CPU and sent to the GPU. But basically the CPU is idle, really idle. It's, all the magic is happening on the GPU. Even the camera movements, because the parameters are computed on the CPU, but the real movements are done in the GPU. I think it's the first, one of the first intros doing this, because the classic approach is to move the camera on the CPU and just send the camera position to the GPU, to the shader. But in this case, we are sending the parameters to the shader, and it's the shader who is computing the really the camera position.
Well, the shader has the benefit of knowing the geometry.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Because the indeed the geometry is the real terrain shape that's defined on the GPU too with a vertex shader, and the CPU doesn't know anything at all about the mountain. It doesn't even know what it's rendering. The CPU just sends just a regular grid, flat plane of triangles, and it's the GPU who converts that into a terrain. So it's the GPU who knows how to make the collision detection or avoid a peak or something. So that's why the camera is on the GPU.
Okay. Cool. Adi, if you don't mind me asking, do you have any particular demo that you want us to view next? That whether you of your own creation or perhaps someone else that you think is pretty cool.
Demo that I like.
Yeah. Preferably your own, right? Because we're talking to you. So.
Yeah. Okay. I like Elevated. I like Elevated a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm really in love with nature and. And especially with terrains and snowy landscapes.
Well, yeah, you did there's another procedural graphic that you did. I don't recall
yes,
the name of
yes,
it often. Yes, Forest Exalen, like a mushroom.
And that's also showing some mountains. And actually, I have been doing terrain rendering since, I think one of my very first effects before I knew the demo scene was already terrain, fractal terrain. And since then, since 97 or 96, I have been doing terrains almost every year. In a way or in another, in a 4K, in a 64K, in a procedural graphics, in my own projects, always. And I really love them. And I guess that's because in Spain, I was born in the north of Spain, which is very cold and snowy. And I spent all the winters when I was a child in the mountains, and skiing and so on. And I love snow and mountains. So I really like Elevated. And yeah, I don't know. I guess if I do anything else again, any 4K or 64K, it will be with nature again, like mountains and these things. I love them a lot. So in that sense, I like Elevated, and I'm very proud of it also. And it was a great experience to do it with the guys of TPC.
How did they go with the party? Did everyone cheer when it played, and did everyone really really like it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm judging this from the. I mean, it was first place, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was not at this party, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, so I don't know because normally when I make a production and it goes into the competition, during the competition I'm very nervous.
Yeah.
I'm in the demo scene. I'm competing since the '98, doing many productions a year. Normally it goes in Spain, but then also in other countries, but. Still, after I think I have done 40 productions so far, and still today I get very nervous when they are projected on the big screen. So when we watched Elevated, I was very nervous. I don't remember much. In fact, I remember people clapping, and I was enjoying a lot. So I went with Mentor, the other coder. We went to the very first row in the at breakpoint. We went to the first places to the seats in front of the screen to sit in this huge screen they have. And I was enjoying it, and I remember being very nervous, but I think people liked it a lot, and they were clapping, and then came and said, oh, you did it, this is the fucking best, whatever. But everything came later, but during the projection, I was just like, well, anyway, in Breakpoint, and I think it's the same in Assembly, they project what they think are the best demos in the end of the competition. So
yeah.
They keep the best productions to the end. So the fact that Elevated was projected the last one was already like a good sign, of course. But still, I was so nervous. yeah, it's very. It's nice. It's like seeing your child doing alone for the first time.
Yeah, the fact that you develop it in kind of a restricted sort of manner to see it on the big screen at such a high resolution, I'm sure is very exciting.
Exciting, yes. And surrounded with lots of people, and with your friends, and it was a bit special, yes. Mm-hmm. It's really nice. So that's why I think that every demo singer should go to demo parties, because especially if you have produced, if you have a demo or an intro, that you have to go to a party. Because for example, I made another 4K intro 2 years ago, I think. It was called Stiletto. That was a walking woman, and it went to the competition of Assembly. So I went. It did compete at Assembly, but I was not there. I couldn't go. And then it got second position, but it had very good reviews. And the fact that I made a production and not being able to watch it live, it was really catastrophic for me, because then I watched some live records, like someone went with a camera and recorded how people reacted to the demo in the big screen, and they liked it a lot, and they clapped, and so on, and I wasn't there to watch it, so it was too bad. So I think everyone should go to a party, and if you have make a demo, go to a party and watch it on the big screen with your friends and your people that you don't know yet, but they will become your friends later, and they will clap, and it's really, really an experience. It's like, wow, it's really nice.
So when's the next party you're going to?
I'm going to Function in Hungary, because that's in September 25, I think, in Budapest. So it's the guys of Conspiracy and the Hungarian demo scene who is organizing it. And so it's a very small party, but it's very, very nice. I like it a lot. I have gone the last 2 years. This will be the third time. And it's very, very nice. It's completely different than Breakpoint, in the sense that it's very familiar. This is very small. It's quiet, but we really enjoy a lot. And normally you have good productions also. So and this summer I didn't go to any party since Breakpoint actually. I didn't go to any party, and I'm really waiting for it. So that's Function.
Right, cool. I hope you have a lot of fun. And I don't say hi to Gargai for me. That's the only person I really know from the Hungarian scene, at least. So
He's the organizer, one of the organizers. So
Yeah.
Normally the problem of being an organizer is that he will be very busy all the time and stressed, because he has to organize the compo, well, you know the story. So they are there for the party, but they are not really enjoying. So Gargai will be there, but he will not
really
enjoy that much.
Enjoy that. Do you mind me asking, without I don't know how secretive you are with RGBA, but do you have any pretty cool frameworks that you've developed over the years? Do you have a very nice tool that you were using? Like, what tools have you developed within this group over the years?
I'm going to disappoint you, I think, because we don't have any tool.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah, well, it's the way we work, or at least the way I work, and because I'm the only active one, the only active member of RGBA, I'm the one who decides, let's say. So, no tools at all. I don't like writing tools. I just like writing demos. I really dislike making user interfaces and plugins for 3ds Max and keeping compatibility. And it's an endless story, I think. And I don't have much time to do programming. I don't spend much time. And the time I invest on demo scene is really for making the demos, not the tools. So we don't have any tool. We just use Visual Studio, so the C compiler of Microsoft, and that's it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So that means that all the animations are done with formulas. We don't have Spline's editor or Bezier curves editors or anything. So we do everything just with formulas. And when we have to move an object, we have to put object.position.x equal sinus of time plus exponential and blah, 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 blah. That's the way we do animations. And so on and so on. I like it because, I don't know, it takes a lot of time to do things, like to get the right movements, the right animations you want, or the right texture, the right whatever you want. But I don't know, it's a different way of thinking, because the other way of doing it is what you would do if you were doing a game or if you were a game developer. And if I wanted to do that, I would get a game developer job. I don't know, I prefer to do it in another way. And I like it. So we don't have any tools. We use Visual Studio, Photoshop, of course, to check from time to time things, and that's it a bit, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a bit disappointing, because normally most groups, they have huge tools which do everything from textures to animation to 3D objects to rendering. They have exporters, they have plugins, they have millions of things, but we don't have anything. I like it.
It's your demos are impressive, nonetheless. I mean, I'm not saying that they would be more impressive, but the fact that you're doing these from scratch every time is pretty cool.
Yeah, and I find it very exciting. Like, for example, with Elevated, the terrain and so on. Many people are telling me, okay, which images did you use as reference, or which videos did you download to as reference or to try to mimic and so on.
Yeah.
And I didn't use anything. I didn't even go to Google for watching images or anything. It just I like the idea of building everything just from my mind through formulas. And I find that very exciting. So if there was an artist designing the mountains and designing the textures, then it wouldn't be that funny for me anymore. I still like to watch demos, of course, the classic demos, I mean, where they are done with Photoshop textures and 3ds Max meshes. That I enjoy watching, but as creator, as active demo scener or programmer, I like to follow this other process of just thinking on something in my mind and then finding the formulas that will bring it to the screen and building something out of nothing. That really I like. I think it's very exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'm gonna close this interview, to be honest with you. So
okay.
Thanks for having the time.
Thanks to you.
Yeah. And take care. And I guess we'll be closing with let's see, what shall we close with?
Maybe the Instant Sun music of STS-04 demo. I love it.
Okay. All right. We'll see you next week, or whenever. It's kind of haphazard, but I like saying see you next week.
for Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.